The show is called Live and Local. It's your local performance connection, and we've got quite a contrast on today's show, starting with a conversation with one of the members of a group called The Green Cards, who will be playing in Bloomington tonight at 8 o'clock at the Castle Theater, and then later talking with one of the two pianists who will be performing Stravinsky's ballet music, The Rite of Spring, Saturday afternoon for free at the University of Illinois. Hope you'll stay tuned. There was a tune called Adelaide performed by The Green Cards, who will be at the Castle Theater in Bloomington tonight at 8 o'clock, with doors opening at 7 o'clock, with special guest, I don't know how you say it, Rego. And on the phone with me right now is a member of The Green Cards, Kim Warner, originally from Australia, as will be evident in a matter of seconds. Thanks very much for joining us.
G'day, Kevin. How are you?
Doing fine. And you're currently residing in Nashville.
Correct. Yeah, the whole band's out of Nashville, Tennessee these days, so it'll be a short little commute up to see you guys. And, yeah, looking forward to it.
So what brought you here?
Well, just the music, you know. I mean, I've had a real fondness for American music all my life. I grew up with it, and particularly acoustic form of music, and just really wanted to come and be a part of the scene. Both Carol and I came over here together about 10 years ago now, 11 years ago, actually. And, just really wanted to sort of try and see what we could get involved in as far as an acoustic music scene. And, you know, 10 years later, the Green Cards are still going strong.
And you have your green card, I assume.
Yeah, we are legit now.
Although, and you mentioned Carol. Carol is Carol Young, a fellow Australian. And then you have two Oregonians.
Yeah, we've had a few guys through the bands over the last 10 years, but we've got two amazing musicians right now, Carl Miner, who's a guitar player, and Luke Buller, both from Oregon. So we're all tied in there with the Pacific Ocean, so it makes perfect sense to us.
So are they originally Oregonians and so don't need green cards?
Correct. They are originally Oregonians, and I think they've lived all over the place. I know Carl, like us, lived in Austin, Texas for a number of years, and I think Luke's been all over the shop as well. So, but all in Nashville now. Great, great, great players.
And I see Carl is a national flat picking championship winner.
Yes, and by no accident, he's one of the greatest guitar players you'll ever hear. He's won a bunch of guitar competitions, but amazingly versatile musician, as is Luke. So it's really, really good time for the band right now.
And do you in your performances manage to do solo showcases of each of you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of instrumental parts within our music anyhow, whether it's a vocal song or obviously an instrumental song. But yeah, we do. I mean, we're playing tune or two that Carl has written, and you know, everyone really does get featured. I mean, Carol is the singer, and that's the main part of the show, really, is the song and the singing. It's sort of what we're about, but there's a lot of playing around that, and yeah, everyone surely does get featured.
And I do notice that in some of your songs you have picked up what I would definitely say is a Nashville sort of sound, a little bit of country music going on in there.
And yeah, well, I mean, you know, the country music that we've been influenced by is really, you know, much much more of a throwback than what you hear on radio nowadays. But we're influenced by a lot of music, you know, and I think that's going to come out in your writing and your performing. We've never sort of been overly concerned about fitting into a club as far as our genre of music is. I just think it's under the umbrella of newgrass or sort of contemporary folk music, I think. And, as I say, we're influenced by a lot of things, a lot of music, and it does come out in our songs.
Well, that's the thing about music anymore, is much of it defies categorization.
I think so, and I think it's a good thing, too. I think we need to stop worrying about whether something fits into a certain thing. If it's good music, it's good music. It shouldn't really matter where it comes from or, you know, what it sounds like. If it's great, it's great.
Well, but then what are interviewers going to ask, you know? What kind of music do you play?
Well, we get asked that a lot. I mean, yeah, I guess it wipes one of the questions out. We get asked that a lot. It's a hard question to ask and answer sometimes.
Well, we just have to be more imaginative, although I do see from your bio that you, in addition to new grass, you refer to a little bit of Latin American music.
Well, you know, I mean, we have a few things that are infused with that sort of South American sound. I've always really liked that style of string band music, and the melodies are just so, I find them really exciting and at the same time it's difficult to play. So, yeah, I mean, that's another thing that fits in. I wouldn't say it's one of the hugest parts of the green cards, but it certainly is there. It's evident.
So you guys have been going since, what, about 2003, and you've already had tours with the likes of Bob Dylan and Willie Nelson. How did you rig those up?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. Next year will be our 10th anniversary of the Green Cards, actually, so we're excited about that. And we've had some really special things, and getting to tour with Bob Dylan and Willie Nelson back in 2005 was one of the biggest highlights we could have ever had. It was just amazing. You know, I don't know how that stuff comes about, but we were really fortunate to be asked to do it, and it was a huge learning curve for us, and just a fantastic experience getting to see those iconic artists, an artist that we love. We really are huge fans of both of them, two of the greatest songwriters ever, two of the greatest ever artists in American music history, I'd say.
So what does that mean, you toured with them? Did you perform with them, or did you open for them, or what? How did that work?
You know, it was a it was kind of like a festival type show. How it would work would be, it was minor league baseball stadiums, and the show would kick off around 5 p.m. and we would play a set for 30 or 40 minutes. And then Willie Nelson would play for an hour or so, and then Dylan would come on and close the night with his full show. So it was we opened the show, and it was amazing. You know, it was sort of 10,000 plus people every day in a stadium type setting, and it really was a learning curve for us because we'd only played, you know, little club gigs really and smaller type festivals. But this was really taught us how to throw our show and how to learn to, you know, what I mean by throw the show, not like bomb the show, but throw the show outward to a stadium type setting, you know. So it was a great, great time, fantastic time for the band.
Did you get a chance when you weren't on stage to jam with Willie Nelson or Bob Dylan?
Well, you know, I mean, Bob was not really around much other than, you know, he would arrive, I'd say 30 minutes or so before his set, and he'd just sort of hang on his bus or be in the car park with his band, and he's a pretty private guy. You know, you're not getting much access to Bob Dylan. So we met him briefly on the last night, said hello to him, and he was really gracious, and that was fantastic. But, you know, Willie and his guys were, if you pardon the pun, wafting around backstage quite a bit, so we got a chance to hang out with those guys quite a bit. And Willie was a really lovely, lovely man, and his band were great, and we did do a bit of jamming with some of the guys in his band, so it was a really great. I think we were out for 7 weeks with them. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I would think if somebody's going to ask you to go on tour with them, they'll at least say hello to you. So I'm glad you got to say hi to Dylan
at least once.
Yeah,
I think I know there's been people that have been around him for a long time, Bob Dylan, and haven't met him. You know, it just happens that way. I think his guitar tech had told us that he hadn't spoken to him in about 7 years. So, you know, he's a pretty private guy.
Apparently, yeah. And he puts it all in his songs, I guess.
Well, I mean, when you know, and it's funny to, you know, not to harp on it too much, but, you know, Willie would go out and he'd sing hit after hit, you know, Whiskey River, Crazy, Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, On the Road Again, all the hits, talk to people, kiss babies, you know, really, you know, personal with the crowd. And Dylan would come out and, you know, he'd play an hour and a half. You might recognize one song from the night before. It would never be the same. And all he would do was introduce his band late in the show, and he never talked to the crowd. It's just two completely different ways of doing it, you know, and no right or wrong way, I guess. So it was, again, a great learning curve.
Sounds like Willie Nelson should run for office.
I'd vote for him.
Yeah, I was going to say, he
gets my citizenship too.
That's right. First things first. Well, here's another first thing first. Let's hear another song from the Green Cards. This is called Heart Fixer. Anything to say about this before we launch into it?
Yeah, well, this is a real special song for us. It was written by Carol and myself and our good mate from Australia, Jed Hughes, who's been a friend of ours for years, and we lived together in Sydney and we lived together in Nashville when we first moved here. And really special because we wrote this song and one of our heroes, Vince Gill, came in and sang and played on it and did a duet with Carol. So it's a really special song for us, this one.
It's called Heart Fixer. The Green Cards will be in Bloomington tonight at 8 o'clock. Kim Warner's my guest here on Live and Local.
Heart fixer, heart fixer, heart fixer.
It's called Heart Fixer with the Green Cards. And vocalists were Carol Young, who is one of the founders of the Green Cards, but also joined by Vince Gill here on Live and Local. Kim Warner's my guest for this portion of our show. And the Green Cards, you can go out and hear live tonight at 8 o'clock. Doors opening at 7 o'clock at the Castle Theater in Bloomington. I notice here, Kim, that you yourself have won at least a championship or two, the Australian National Bluegrass Mandolin Championship. How prominent is bluegrass as a form in Australia?
Well, probably as much as you'd expect. It's not hugely prominent, let's just say that. There are people that play it and play it well, but it's just sort of, you know, little pockets of music in Australia where you'll find it. I mean, for me, I just grew up in a family that loved that sort of music, and my father plays still to this day, so I was around it, and it was just second nature to me growing up to hear, you know, all sorts of American roots music. But you have to really search for it to find it in Australia. I mean, it's still somewhat of a minority music here in America, I guess, but it's way more prolific and prominent here than it is back home, for sure.
Well, it seems to be picking up here, but I may simply be more aware of it since I started to do this particular radio show. I'm not sure which is which. So if one says roots music in Australia, what kind of music will we be talking about?
Well, I mean, not too dissimilar to the sort of Americana scene that you might find here. But it may have a more of an Australian tinge thing. I mean, we have artists in Australia that sort of like what Guy Clark is here, or Townes Van Zandt, or those sort of iconic American artists that sing about, you know, real life here in America. Like Merle Haggard sing about the land. You know, we have Australian artists that are iconic in that way too. So I guess the roots music scene would be infused with an American form, as well as a combination of some of that stuff too. So there's been some artists that have done really well, like The Waif, I would put as a roots music act, and John Butler, Xavier Rudd, Casey Chambers has had great success. So all these artists sort of draw on both the Australian and the American grassroots form of music.
I had the perhaps a stereotypical image of Australian roots music involving a didgeridoo.
Well, it's there sometimes. That is very roots to Australian, that's for sure, the Aboriginal, famous Aboriginal iconic instrument. And there have been some artists that have you know, incorporated that into their sound. I don't know if you remember a band called Yothu Yindi, who were an all Aboriginal band, but they had some real international success, and they were singing even in the native language a lot of the time.
But you haven't so far incorporated a didgeridoo into the Green Cards.
Not as yet, because it's impossible to play. I can't get the circular breathing thing to happen.
No, so you have tried.
I mean, I don't think there's any Australian that hasn't been somewhere where someone has a didgeridoo and you've had a go at it. It's really, for me, it's impossible. I don't know how anyone can get a sound out of it, but it's kind of cool when you do.
Yeah, we did a show here where we had, there's actually a small didgeridoo band here in Champaign-Urbana. I think they're still around. And
an old didgeridoo band?
Well, that means two players. Wow. But there is a band called Tree Thump that incorporates the didgeridoo routinely, and one guy was telling me that he just decided that he got himself into a hammock with the didgeridoo and decided he wasn't getting out until he'd figured out how to play it.
Wow, how many months did he stay in that hammock?
I don't know, but it was a remarkably small period of time.
Wow.
And he seems to play it quite well. He said it's meditative.
Yeah, well, yes. Yeah, absolutely. It really does take an enormous amount of concentration, and obviously something I don't have enough of because I've never been able to do it.
Well, but you have to have a lot of patience and concentration to master the mandolin at the level which you have.
Well, it does take work to be, reasonable at anything, I guess. It takes some time. But the breathing thing was the thing with the didgeridoo that I always really struggled with.
Breathing is good. Breathing is good.
Breathing is good.
Even when you play mandolin.
Well, it can be helpful, yes.
Breathe with the music. That's what teachers always tell you, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, want to go out with one more song. Do these all, by the way, the ones we're playing, do these all come off of your latest album, the Brick album?
Yeah, these are all off the Brick album, absolutely.
What's the inspiration for that title?
Well, the the artwork for the record is a brick wall, and obviously with a brick wall there's lots of individual bricks, and there's names of people on those bricks, and they contributed to us to help fund this record, because this is the first time ever that the Green Card's been an independent artist. So we needed a little help, and we've got this great following of fans, grassroots music people. They're not just fans of our band, but of just music in general, that got behind us and bought a brick, and in return they got their name actually on the artwork forever. You know, it's there permanently. And we had all these wonderful folks that contributed, so that's why we wanted to call it the Brick Album. And it sort of really sums it all up for us. It was really challenging, but incredibly, incredibly rewarding. And we're just so thankful to all the folks that have supported us for the last, you know, nearly 10 years and got involved with this project. It's been really great.
So the Beatles have the White Album and the Green Cards have the Brick Album.
Not quite as successful, but who knows?
Yet. That's right. Kim Warner is one of the founders of the Green Cards. It's a quartet of players, along with Carol Young, Carl Miner, and tell me the fourth person again, please.
Luke Buller.
Luke Buller, and they're all going to be at the Castle Theater in Bloomington tonight at 8 o'clock. You can get in starting at 7 o'clock, and for more information on the theater shows, go to thecastletheater.com. For more information on the Green Cards, go to thegreencards.com, and we'll go out with a tune that is called Make It Out West. You're listening to Live and Local. Make It Out West by the Green Cards. They'll be at the Castle Theater in Bloomington tonight at 8 o'clock, and you're hearing them on Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. Our broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: AgriGold Hybrids of Mahomet, Provena Covenant Medical Center of Urbana, First National Bank and Trust Company of Clinton, Michael W. Walker Consulting of Urbana. And these business partners join the Friends of WYLL in making great programs possible. Thank you very much for your support. And thanks to all of our individuals who support this station as well with your financial contributions. We do also have support from Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting David Robertson conducting the St. Louis Symphony in an evening bookended by Wagner and Sibelius on Sunday, October 16th. More information is available at krannertcenter.com. Next up on our program, I'll be talking with pianist Christian Matias, who is a professor of dance and music at the University of Michigan. He's coming to the University of Illinois on Saturday to perform with pianist Ilya Blinov Stravinsky's ballet, Le Sacre du Printemps, or The Rite of Spring, and also give a pre-concert lecture. It's a free program, 4 o'clock at Smith Memorial Hall on Saturday. Look forward to that. And here is the opening music to the orchestral version of that piece. ¶¶ We just heard the iconic opening to the work by Stravinsky that caused quite literally a riot on its first performance. It's called The Rite of Spring, which was a ballet, although most often played as an orchestral piece. And that's, of course, how you heard it there in a performance by the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Claudio Abbado. It is extremely difficult to play. I can tell you it's extremely difficult to conduct. And it is an awful lot of fun to listen to, and I'd sure love to see it sometime. You can hear a performance of the work this Saturday, starting at 4 o'clock or a little bit after 4 o'clock, in Stravinsky's own version for two pianos, or piano four hands originally, by pianists Ilya Blinov and Christian Matias. And Mr. Matias is on the phone with me right now. He's associate professor of dance, believe it or not, at the University of Michigan. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, very happy to do so.
So how does a pianist end up in a dance department?
I guess it would be the odd chance of my having done a great deal of study in dance, both ballet and modern and some other world forms. So I sort of by default became a dance music specialist, the way you have pianists who are experts in accompanying opera and coaching opera, and has studied the work quite thoroughly. I'm one of the very, you know, small minority of pianists out there who put a lot of their study into the dance repertory and dance history. So
when you say you studied those dance forms, meaning you were dancing?
No, I wasn't dancing. I studied the works, studied the choreography. I studied methods that they were notated, practices, performance practice issues, which grew out of my own graduate study at university was in early music performance. So in that field, you're a performer, but you also study performance practice and the aesthetics, you know, relevant to that period. So when I started working in dance, I took many of the same methods in looking at choreography and reading. You know, you research the work the way you would any other work and study, and you try to see as much of it as is possible in that same framework.
What drew you to do that?
I think it was a series of unexpected turns. You know, the Bugs Bunny line about I took a wrong turn at Albuquerque, I think there was probably some of that involved. And I was already a fairly decent pianist and could play dance rep, so it would, where I grew up in Los Angeles, if somebody, a guest artist came into town and they needed somebody who could play, you know, a pas de deux from a Tchaikovsky ballet or knew how to perform at a high level, some of the more obscure 19th century ballet rep it off, people would somehow be referred to me, and I got to be known as somebody who could play that rep and understood the subtleties. And outside of the United States, in Europe, you'll find more musicians who are specialists in this area. But in the States, aside from New York and a few pockets around the country, there aren't too many people who, you know, can pull the, you know, some obscure 19th century ballet out and play it fairly well. So I think it's just sort of a series of accidents, and you just get known in that way, and one thing leads to the other.
So you're going to be giving the pre-concert lecture on Saturday, starting at 4 o'clock for the Rite of Spring, and you call it the Rite of Spring, or in French, Le Sacre du Printemps, music from dance. What do you mean by that?
Well, there are a great number of scores that are in the 20th century concert repertory that originated as works for dance, Le Sacre being probably the most prominent, but Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet and Cinderella ballets are widely known to concert audiences. Prokofiev's Scythian Suite grew out of a dance score that he wrote. Satie's most incendiary works or challenging works he wrote for the Ballet Soudain, which was a sort of a Dadaist dance company, and he wrote also for the Ballet Russe. And you have Mio's Creation of the World, and of course all the other Stravinsky ballets that he wrote for Diaghilev and afterwards, so Firebird and Petrushka, Pulcinella, Apollo, are works that originated in dance. And I believe that I think dance has been short-shrifted and has gone astray in this country in many ways. And so audiences are not drawn to dance. I think mostly through the guilty. I put the blame squarely at the foot of the dance profession, who did not seem to know how to reach out to audiences in a way. I always say that if you go to a dance concert, most of the audience are people who are either dancers or are by default fans of dance. And you go to a music concert and you'll find people who are at a music concert for the first time, and that's not at all unexpected. At a dance concert, you find far less of that, and I think it's made it hard for the field to keep as an active participant in our cultural life and our cultural heritage. So all to get back to the idea that so many of these scores that we think of as orchestral works or concert works actually grew out of dance, and they're everything about them, from the style and personality of the works to the rhythmic construction to the overall experience of the work, was intended to be part of a kinesthetic experience, i.e. a dance experience. And once we remove it from dance, yes, we can play the rhythms correctly, we can play the notes as the page dictates, but we've lost that crucial element of the music that gives it that very fresh, almost on the verge of coming apart spark, is what I refer to it, because when it's put together with dance, there's an excitement that this thing is happening, and there's all this movement, and there's all this sound, and the sound is it's a very synergistic relationship when it's performed live. So you have that relationship, and the music can stand on its own. So you take the music away, and you can shape it and polish it in very different ways, but we lose track of the fact that the piece had a certain chance element that gave it a level of excitement that is pretty hard to replicate elsewhere. It's like seeing very good opera. When you see opera really well performed, it always has that feeling like at any moment it can come apart, but it's held together by all of these wonderful components working in tandem. So,
of all the ballets you mentioned as being better known as orchestral works these days, I can think of only one of those that I've ever seen, much less heard about anybody doing on stage, and that would be Romeo and Juliet of Prokofiev, which gets done on stage quite a lot.
Yeah.
But I don't think I've ever seen any reference even to, although I'm sure it happens, to contemporary ballet companies doing any of those three ballets of Stravinsky, the famous ones, Firebird, Petrushka, or certainly not The Rite of Spring.
The Joffrey Ballet of Chicago began in the 1980s performing the original Nijinsky choreography to Petrushka and the original choreography to Firebird. Though Firebird had been around in the repertory consistently, but Petrushka and far less so La Sacra, which was reconstructed for the Joffrey Ballet back in the early 1980s, they do perform the Nijinsky choreography, but there are not a great number of companies that perform that. But La Sacra, as I said, being one of the most popular of Stravinsky's dance scores, is widely performed and has been choreographed by all manner of people.
One of these days I'll get to see it, I hope.
There is a video of it. There is a video, and many university libraries will have this in their collection because it's a standard videos work, but the Joffrey Ballet did record their reconstruction of it back in the 80s. And it's, yes, on video it loses some of the immediacy of the live performance, but I saw the live performances in the mid-80s when they were touring it, and it was, it's sort of mind-blowing to to experience even all these years later to think that this ballet is almost a century old.
Well, it still is. It doesn't cause fist fights in the aisles as it literally did at that first performance, but it still sounds like a really revolutionary piece, and it's incredibly exciting. Let's get back to some of the music. What I want to do here is play a little bit of the second section of the first part of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring in the London Symphony recording with Claudio Abbado, and then we're going to sort of segue into Stravinsky's own pianola version, which is his recording on top of himself, so to speak, his pianoforehands version, which is what you guys are going to be doing on two pianos on Saturday. And this section is called The Dance of the Young Girls, one translation of that anyway. And it's by Stravinsky, and you're listening to Live and Local. We heard a portion of The Rite of Spring, the ballet by Stravinsky, first played by the London Symphony, conducted by Claudio Abbado, and then played by Stravinsky himself on the pianola, the section called The Dances of the Young Girls. And it's I can imagine the initial audience hearing that, and I don't even know how to describe that music, violent, to say the least, and it even gets more so as the piece progresses, being just completely shocked about what was going on musically and probably whatever it was they were seeing on stage. You can see a two-piano performance of the complete Rite of Spring on Saturday at 4 o'clock at Smith Memorial Hall on the University of Illinois campus. It's actually free. It'll be played by pianists Ilya Blinov here at the University of Illinois and Christian Matias, who is professor at University of Michigan, and he's my guest here on Live and Local. Christian, what are the particular challenges, and I'm sure there are many, to transferring this music from orchestra to piano? I don't mean, you know, the compositional aspect of it, but the performing aspect of it.
Stravinsky was an excellent pianist, and he did initially score this for piano, as it would have had to have been rehearsed to piano when it was first staged in 1913. The piano writing, if it can be imagined, does fit relatively well under the hands. It's not easy to play by any means, but being a pianist and being aware of trying to capture the piece on a different, very different timbre level of the piano, the piece has a great range of color, even in the piano version. Being able to convey the energy of the piece is not all that difficult because the piece is sort of bursting at the seams in every way. So if you follow the score and understand the work and are not too overly concerned with being a pianist, you can actually have a very exciting performance of the work.
Well, if he, so I probably asked the question in the backwards way. If he started with the piano version, I guess compositionally it would be really interesting to talk to composer about how Stravinsky went the other way, adding all the instrumental colors to the piano, which of course you can present the chords, you can present the melodies such as they are in this piece, and there are some, but you especially on the piano can convey all the percussive energy of the piece.
Yeah, and you know, Stravinsky, it's known, composed in a sort of an expanded short score. So while he was writing it, he was creating, you know, elements of the orchestral version, and then he was also putting it together to be playable on the piano. So, you know, he was not writing simply for the piano and then transferring it to orchestra or vice versa. He was thinking along both lines at the same time, and his sketches and in interviews he talks about composing and how his style was to use this expanded short score for many pieces. So you did have the work existing in both timbral worlds simultaneously while he was composing it. And as the work was premiered within a year of its being completed, there wasn't any lag per se, though he did make revisions to the orchestration and to some of the metric layout in later editions. The piano and orchestral versions are simultaneous creations in many ways.
I want to hear, of course, a little bit more of the piece, but give us a real small thumbnail sketch of what happens in the ballet, or what's it about? Why is it called The Rite of Spring?
Well, the libretto to the ballet, which well, nobody buys CDs anymore, but if you bought CDs, there's...
I buy CDs, excuse me, I buy CDs.
Okay, well then, the four of us out there who buy CDs, the libretto's often explained there. It's the story of pagan Russia and the ritual process of sacrificing a young girl to the gods so that they will have a fruitful and healthy harvest. And the dance... The original libretto to the dance was the, was a a reenactment of what they imagined a pagan ritual would have been. And that story has been the primary understanding of the ballet, but the musicologist Glenn Watkins, in his book, The Pyramids at the Louvre, talks about the work actually being more, or not more, but being as influenced by ritual dances of Native North American Indians, because in his research, he found that there were many tours to Europe and Russia of American Indian shows, dance shows. So, you know, the sort of rich, like in this country, we had the Buffalo Bill Wild West shows. These sort of shows traveled frequently to Europe and to Russia. And Professor Watkins sees the dance as being equally influenced by Stravinsky's imagination of what pagan Russia must have appeared to be, but also having been exposed to dances by, you know, the Native American Indians in this country while they were traveling there. So it's, I've had to kind of realign my thinking of moving it away from the pagan Russian ritual aspect and try to understand that there are probably many more influences in the dance than we've long held to expect.
Let's listen to another section here, exclusively in Stravinsky's performance. This is the section from part two called The Sacrifice, and this specific section called The Glorification of the Chosen One, or The Glorification on the Chosen One, it says here. It's Igor Stravinsky playing from his own score, The Rite of Spring, and you can hear the two-piano version played by Ilya Blinov and my guest, Christian Matias, at the University of Illinois on Saturday afternoon at 4 o'clock. You're listening to Live and Local. That section was called The Glorification of the Chosen One, from Part Two, The Sacrifice, of the ballet The Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky, which you can hear played in the two-piano version on Saturday afternoon at 4 o'clock. One of the performers and also the person giving the pre-concert lecture is Professor of Music and Dance at the University of Michigan, Christian Matias, who's my guest here on Live and Local. So you've been working on this with Ilya Blinov, your colleague, for a while. I should mention that this performance is part of a series he's presenting of lecture recitals that he's calling Roughly Russian. The first one happened last month, and the next one will be on the 12th of November, and he's calling it Beethoven Mysteries of the Moonlight. So the Roughly Russian part, I'll be interested in talking to Ilya later on about how he works that into there, but should let folks know that is part of a series. Have you had a chance to play this piece with dancers yourself?
Yes. We, at Michigan, we were given a license to restage the Paul Taylor choreography to this dance. So Ilya and I performed the piece for the staging of the dance here at Michigan, which was almost 2 years ago.
Did anybody riot in the aisles?
No one rioted in the aisles, but it seems to have achieved the appropriate effect of giving an experience. I mean, Lesakra is so much part of the standard canon. We think of it as commonly as we could think of Elvis Presley singing Hound Dog or most anything, but for people to actually be wowed by it or excited by it or have their eyes or ears open to it in a different way, it seemed to have been successful in that means.
Well, I know on the few occasions when I've actually heard the regular orchestra version, so to speak, live, I still find it just a remarkably new an amazing piece. I mean, it sounds like it could have been written 2 days ago. It's that contemporary seeming.
Well, it's, I think it's just a timeless work, and Stravinsky knew he had a masterwork on his hands, and You know, for many people, once they create their big work, it's difficult for them to match that. But, you know, Stravinsky went on and created God knows how many fantastic works after that time. I mean, he lived until 1971, and I'm sure you can probably name half a dozen works that still stand out as masterpieces. So to think that this was early in his career and he still had, you know, countless works to go, that just shows breadth of his work and the level of sort of otherworldly genius that he had. So
I'm actually looking here, and I've forgotten, when was this piece first performed?
1913. And the reason Ilya and I are performing it a fair deal, now we're performing it in Richmond, Virginia in a couple of weeks as well, is that we're leading up to the 100th anniversary of the dance premiere, and so we're performing it sort of as a general acknowledgement of the centenary of the work.
Well, I'm sure that it'll be an exciting event on Saturday. It's at 4 o'clock, a free performance of the complete ballet Le Sacre du Printemps, or The Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky, by pianists Ilya Blinov and Christian Matias. Professor Matias will give a pre-concert lecture, which he says won't be terribly long, the lecture itself will start at 4 o'clock, and then it'll be followed by the performance. Professor Matias is at the University of Michigan. He's been my guest here on Live and Local, and I appreciate very much your taking the time to talk with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Kevin.
And here's the final sacrificial dance from The Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky. The conclusion of Stravinsky's ballet, The Rite of Spring, in a performance by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Claudio Abbado. You're listening to 90.9 WYLL-FM and HD Urbana, with translators W266AF Urbana and W293AF Danville, NPR and Classical Music for Central Illinois. WYLL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois, and we have support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com. And remember, you can go out and see a live performance with two pianos of The Rite of Spring Saturday at 4 o'clock, played by Ilya Blinov and Christian Matias. It's 83 degrees at a minute past 1 o'clock.